shut off cell phones and how they all began.
About the history in the last 400 years in the United States of economic upturns and downturns, and how this is just another blip on our screen, we hope. John, I will leave that to you to tell us more. Thank you.
Thank you, John. I got to tell you, I'm a bit disappointed this morning because I wanted to talk a little bit about the Depression of the 1930s, but you're way too young. None of you were around then, so unfortunately, I can't get firsthand experience. As John mentioned, when you talk about 400 years of economic crisis, we could be here until July, and I promise I won't keep you until then, just after noon. I may focus, if you don't mind, especially on the 18th century, the birth of our nation, the United States of America, and a man by the name of Alexander Hamilton, who formed the first bank in the United States, the Bank of New York. It depends on what day of the week if you ask me if I say he was a great man or a very strange man. So we'll be talking about him. But when John mentions folklorist, it means that I don't have a prefix or a suffix or a mortgage-sized student loan following me around. I've been called a rogue nostalgian, an ad hoc science lector. These are the things that I can say in public, by the way. A pocket historian or a non-academic storyteller. Basically, I like to bring a contemporary and invigorating view to American history, because if it weren't for contemporary genealogy, then America would have lost her grasp of her grand heritage altogether. And let me tell you, everybody, doing these lectures for the last 5 years, it's rare that I find anybody under 50 attending my lectures, and it's very, very sad. I belong to a number of historical societies, including Watertown and Waltham, and if I break out into a hockey announcer's voice, I apologize. One of my part-time endeavors is I'm the Boston Bruins alumni hockey announcer. I do their show hockey announcing. And I also work with the New England Patriots as their basketball announcer, but that's another story on another day. Cell phone's off, please. Usually when I say that, mine rings. It's off. You can interject questions at any time. My axiom is there's always someone in attendance who knows more about the subject than I do, and of course someone who thinks that they know more about the subject than I do. I deal with them all accordingly. Fire exits right out here to the left. You know where the restrooms are. I have websites, and I organize something known as the New England History Festival, which is coming this November 14th. In fact, I just signed a John F. Kennedy impersonator. So today we're going to be talking about booms, bubbles, busts, depressions, recessions, and panics. I could also throw waves in there. And we're going to look at the financial turmoil of the 17th century, upheavals and bubbles of the 18th century, and centuries of panics, the age of oil, engines, rail, air, and war, the great crash, booms, recessions, frenzies, and slides of the 20th century, the dot-com bubble, and the total collapse of 2008 and 2009, and something I know as the China syndrome. Now, I said this back in November 2006, and I'm not going to pat myself. Yes, I am going to pat myself on the back. Many things affect the boom in property, not the least of which is employment stability. The global boom in resources and exports to China and India, positive export trade and strength of precious metals, will all continue to ensure that the West continues to enjoy high living standards and wealth creation. However, if the double-digit growth continues, a correction in the housing market and salaries is inevitable. If any of the global growth factors changes significantly, the landing will be hard and hardship will follow. The growth and inevitable rising consumption in an affluent society may trigger inflation with attendant interest rate hikes. There are too many external factors which could trigger a massive credit default and a consequential banking collapse, so prudence would dictate the growth of personal savings. Said that in November of 06. So this lecture is not purely about economics. The United States has suffered through and recovered from many financial crises throughout its history. Booms and speculative bubbles always follow economic downturns. So what I'm saying is there's a rocket ride out of this thing. Personally, I think that we're in the second inning of this economic crisis, and I see this, I'll tell you, going through till 2020. Will the U.S. economy recover from this current financial stock market fallout? Housing speculation and credit default has fueled today's deep recession. The devaluation and possible collapse, I'm saying possible collapse of the dollar, may drive this country into a deep depression, the likes of which have only been seen once before. Business oracles were and still are wrong. Listen up, Suze Orman. Listen up, Jim Cramer. Their aggressive and now conservative posture has decimated personal financial portfolios. My question is, Are your wounded mutual funds full of corporate corpses? My dad lost everything on something called Lucent Technologies, if you ever remember that. These cycles and super cycles are natural, and they're the pulse of capitalism. They occur at regular intervals. An economy either rides it out or disengages from capitalism altogether. There's no in between. Capitalism usually follows communism via socialism. Now you have to ask yourself, is the inverse true? It's frightening. Will the government have to absorb major industries to ensure that America functions properly so as to ultimately position itself for a recovery? Socialism fosters oligarchies, which are monopolistic power seizures. I hearken back to Russia during the Yeltsin era, 1990s, after the wall fell. And an elimination of competition, which is the driving force of free enterprise. Free enterprise is the lifeblood of capitalism. And as soon as that goes away, we are done as a capitalistic country. And that's why, although I didn't vote for this president, I want him to succeed, but he's treading on ground that we have never, ever seen in our history. And I hope that he makes the right decisions with the bailouts and the TARP and giving money to these companies that we all know ultimately winds up in the pockets of executives who are overpaid and underworked. If I look at American industry, I'll say I've never seen, I'll quote Winston Churchill, I've never seen so many people paid so well to do so little. And that's what the executives are. And there's a bunch of unethical, immoral corporate crooks in America. And unfortunately, they hide under the moniker of CEO or vice president. I'll get off my pedestal right there. But that's the people that they're going to golden parachute each other. Here's the golden parachute for you. When it doesn't get to the workers, doesn't get to the products, it goes into their own pockets. And these people should be brought up on criminal charges because I feel that they are a more dangerous enemy to the United States than Al-Qaeda itself. And that's my only comment. The American economy of the next generation may reveal itself in a very unfamiliar form with a different currency. You walk away from dollar debt. It must be the ingenuity and the determination of the American people that will pull this country and the West out of this cataclysm. Lessons learned: while most nations embroiled unilaterally in long wars eventually undergo extreme economical corrections, namely bankruptcy and consequential social upheaval. I've studied it, folks, back to 1470, and it repeats itself over and over again. And that's why I put my hands on my cheeks when I see that we're embroiled in two wars, and I see that saber rattler in the Korean Peninsula, and then I see that other madman in Iran, although personally I think he should stay in power because he'll bring that country down all by himself. And I get worried. We have to get out. We have to stop being the global policeman. We cannot afford that. Stock market corrections are exacerbated by cash outs, bank runs, and investor panics. And that's what we'll look at. There's always some element of fraud in any speculative bubble or mania. Someone's always not telling the truth. Someone's always pocketing something. And again, these are things that I've culled from studying, I guess it's now 600 years, of capitalism. Many investors fail to recognize the peak of their investment's returns and end up losing their former large gains. Greed, long-term budget deficits, and credit default usually buckle a robust capitalistic society. Some investors never learn and are like a trapeze artist, swinging from one investment opportunity to another. America was affected by panics in Europe and vice versa. So today's lecture will show you the first instances in Western civilization of inflation, people going out of windows due to financial troubles. This is my favorite part, and I still think that we should bring this back. We'll get there in a moment. Fraud, currency devaluation, and the printing of money, copyright violation, credit and long-term loans, the stock market, and wild speculation. I'm going to briefly look at the price revolution. I want to focus in the United States from 1470 to 1620. Something known as the Statute of Monopolies, the Tipper and Seesaw Time of the 30 Years' War, Pilgrims and Puritans, something known as Tulipomania, the Darien Scheme, and then we'll go into the American, those are just some images of the plague. Doctors would wear that mask during the plague. That was before they bled you, as you know. Now, HMOs are bleeding you. So what's a price revolution? Well, again, it's basically, I tried to find ground zero of inflation. Where did inflation take off? And after the Black Death of the 1380s, where the population in Europe was decimated, there was basically more money than people, more goods and more food than people. You had silver being mined in Eastern Europe, and then you had the conquistadors, Hernandez Cortez, a.k.a. Cortez the Killer, the Pizarro brothers. That sounds like a bad Latino act, but they were a bad Latino act. They went and sacked the Aztecs and the Incas, both Cortez and the Pizarros, and they brought back loads of wealth, gold, and dumped it into the European market. You saw coin values. When they started, somebody came up with the idea, well, why don't we debase the coinage due to the inflation of prices? In other words, water down the coinage. Instead of having 100% gold, make it 50%. Make it 10% gold and mix it in with cheaper metals. And of course, the guy who came up with that, the great debasement, was King Henry VIII. And he brought down England's economy from 1542 to 1552 because he reduced the purity of silver coinage by 66%. There's our friend. So, the Gold Coast in Africa, Portuguese were extracting and importing silver from Peru beginning in 1545, and also from their Gold Coast fortress of São Jorge beginning in the 1460s. So there was a tremendous influx of gold and silver into the European economies. Don't worry, I'm not going to read all that, I promise. This is one of the scariest paintings. It's called Triumph of Death. That's by Peter Bruegel. 1562 was painted in. So early inflation, prices in Western Europe rose sixfold over 150 years. In England, prices had risen sevenfold by the 1640s due to a quintupling of silver production in Central Europe. And of course, as I mentioned, the Black Death, depopulation, when the population finally rebounded, well, prices skyrocketed because, as you're seeing right now, for instance, let's say there's 10 department stores, okay, that provide commodities. And in a bad economy, 7 go out of business. That demand was there from the beginning. It's just that people don't have the money now to buy those products. So once they get the money back, well, there's going to be a shortage because you only have 3 stores as opposed to the 10 that we were used to. And that's what happened in the Black Death. As the population skyrocketed, there were more mouths to feed. Farming land that wasn't needed when the population went down is now needed. Agricultural, so you're going to see a huge increase in the price of goods in Europe following the Black Death, following the next 250, 300 years, entering the 17th century. It was known as a dislocation of supply. So prices of goods tended to rise because of dislocation of supply, and later on, the increased population placed greater demands on agricultural products. There were more mouths to feed. And then there was something known as urbanization. This increased trade between Europe's regions, which made prices more responsive to distant changes in demand, but people were flocking to cities for work and for goods. This is a nice thing, the cash trap. Basically, increased trade and availability of manufactured and luxury goods, especially in the 16th century, had also encouraged many landowners to convert their tenants' payments from produce to cash. And of course, they converted farmland to pasture land. One of the Irish famine in the 1840s, the landowners would much rather have cattle eating grass and grazing than having those annoying Irish peasants farming, trying to make a living with potatoes, and therefore they drove them off the land. End of the price revolution happened in 1620, which is right at the time that the pilgrims came over. Well, in 1623, you saw the end of monopolies. And basically in England, it generally condemned monopolies. The king was crooked, and Parliament decided to restrict the king issuing what was known as open letters. In other words, he would hit up his patronage. Again, we're talking oligarchies of people, friends. He would give them letters which said basically that they are granted monopolies in certain industries, certain business verticals, and they don't have to pay taxes on their profits. Sound familiar? Then there was the first protection of intellectual property, and Parliament actually restricted the Crown's power explicitly so that the King could only issue letters and patents to the inventors or introducers of original inventions. And then, as I mentioned, the defenestrations, people getting thrown out of the window. I hearken back, if people got mobs together and decided if they didn't like their state representative or their senator, and they went up to their office and threw he or her out the window. I'm just thinking off the top of my head, Newt Gingrich, perhaps, Dianne Feinstein, Rush Limbaugh, although that would take the whole room of us to get him out the window. Maybe they'd act differently. But the first defenestration of Prague saw the killing of seven members of the city council by a crowd of radical Czech Hussites on July 30th, 1419. They basically came upstairs and out you go. And now you talk about the man who was thrown out of the window. His name was Zelevsky. And Zelevsky just happened to fall in a pile of horse dung. Now, of course, the Catholic side said that he was saved by angels. The Protestants said, no, that's a bunch of blank blank. There was also a second defenestration of Prague in 1618. More people went out the window. So it was the right of freedom of religion the people were seeking. And then, of course, something I called horse chip pile diving. The 30 Years' War now, this is the Saint Bartholomew's Day massacre you're seeing depicted here. There was defenestrations in 1483. King Ferdinand and Cardinal Richelieu. Does anybody know Cardinal Richelieu? Well, he was the Spanish Inquisition, right? So Ferdinand II was the Holy Roman Emperor and King of Bohemia. His firm Catholicism was the proximate cause of the 30 Years' War. Cardinal Richelieu, France, although overwhelmingly Roman Catholic, was a rival of the Holy Roman Empire in Spain. Now, a lot of people like to pin this is the First World War or this is the First World War, and they totally ignore the battle campaigns of Alexander or Xerxes. So this was a world war, and you'll see me later referring to a First World War. It was a terrible war, though. It was the most destructive conflicts in European history, fought primarily in Germany. The war was fought largely as a religious conflict between Protestants and Catholics in the Holy Roman Empire. The war was the extensive destruction of entire regions denuded by the foraging armies. Episodes of famine and disease significantly decreased the populace of the German states in the Low Countries and Italy while bankrupting most of the combatant powers. So this just showed that after this major war, a lot of countries just went out of business. And this just shows you the division of Europe in 1648, Holy Roman Empire, had a bunch of nations, Catholic League, something known as the Catholic League, Austria, Bavaria, Kingdom of Hungary, Croatia, Spanish Empire versus Sweden, Bohemia, Denmark, Dutch Republic, France, Saxony, Electrical Palatinate, England, Brandenburg, Prussia, Transylvania, Hungarian, and the anti-Habsburg rebels. Well, the Holy Roman Empire fielded 450,000 men, and the Spanish could only field about 300,000 combined with the German and English. It was about 495,000. So you have half a million versus half a million. It culminated in the Battle of Lens, which was August 20th, 1648, the last major battle of the war. Lens is a fortified city in the historic region of Flanders in northern France. The French were at a disadvantage during the war. The French army was only 16,000 men and 18 guns. The Spanish had more guns and 18,000 men, but basically what the French did is outflank them with their cavalry and win the Battle of Lens and for all intent and purpose end the 30 Years' War. So you see some Dutch scales that were used here in the 17th century, and this was known as the Tipper and Seesaw Time. It was a financial crisis, and its name given to the financial crisis during the start of the 30 Years' War. So you have a major war, and you have a major economic worldwide crisis of the participants or combatants in that war. Everybody was broke and suffering, and again, you're going to see the debasement of currency, and in other words, the devaluation of the currency go down, because there now all of a sudden was a shortage of precious metals. All of that silver that was coming in from mines in South America, Central and Eastern Europe, all that gold that had been plundered from Mexico and from the isthmus of Central America and South America was now out. There were people that were hoarding it. And therefore, there was a shortage of precious metals. It drives the currency up. And so what they did is they watered down the currency, or specie, as they call the coins. They basically said they reduced the quantity of gold and silver and copper with nickel and iron and other metals. And then Wipperscheid and Kipper, in order to establish their worth, coins had to be weighed. And these were laid on a specially made scale called a Wipp or a seesaw. and they were weighed by a tipper. That was the man who did it. And if the coin was full value, then the whip would tip the kipper. So that's when you see people now, if you give them a 20, they basically put a line to see if it's forged or not. That's, I think, well, this is tipper and seesaw time here in 2009. They just did that to my 50. Those few and precious times that I do have a 50 on me. And I can't even... But, of course, it's susceptible to fraud. If you get involved with the tipper, if you tip the tipper, he'll take care of you. And he'll adjust the scales where nobody's looking and make it so your coin is worth more money. And... this is just a depiction of some of the shysters. But there was year-to-year inflation. The populace tried to hold on to their silver money, but as the rulers of larger states joined in the fraud in 1619, inflation increased from year to year. Starvation resulted. Children's toys. More and more mints were established until the debased metal coins were so worthless that children played with them in the street, which became the basis for the short story by Leo Tolstoy called Ivan the Fool. So when you see kids playing with dollar bills, everybody... you know we're in trouble. And it was the end of kipper money. Blame for forgeries went to the coin makers, but the guilty ones were the princes, the moneyers, and the bishops. After Austria and later the Holy Roman Empire of German nations rose up against the kipper money, it was outlawed in 1622. And then old coinage was returned. This is the relief of Leiden, 1574. So what about the pilgrims in Holland? Well, they were broke. They were a congregation of English expatriates, and William Bradford noted that, hey, we're all aging and compounding the difficulties. Some hadn't supported themselves. Some had spent their savings, given up, and returned to England. So it was feared that more people would follow and that they would leave Holland. And at that time, they decided to go abroad and check out the New World. The employment, the youths were leaving as well in droves. They wanted nothing to do with freedom of religion. They were trying to find just where they could make a buck. And then there was a new beginning. There were discouragements of the hard life, finding a better and easier place of living where they could preach and pray in peace. And that's when they focused on the new land, the new world that they had heard about. And of course, the economic worries of the pilgrims, Edward Winslow's list was similar. He stated that there were economic worries and missionary possibilities, so he thought that it was important for people to retain their English identity, their culture, and their language, but more importantly, to establish themselves in a new world. So there was a Dutch revolt in the 80 Years' War. This went from 1568 to 1648. And it began as a revolt against King Philip II of Spain. And it basically evolved into a general war for Dutch independence. There was a 12 years truce in 1609. When peace proved fleeting, however, conflict resumed in the form of conventional war between the Dutch Republic and the Spanish Empire. The Peace of Westphalia was a permanent split of the Habsburg Netherlands into two parts that roughly corresponded with present-day Netherlands and Belgium-Luxembourg. A new great power developed in the course of the conflict, and as a consequence of its fiscal military innovations, the Dutch Republic emerged as a great power, whereas the Spanish Empire lost its European hegemonic status. A lot of that has to do with the Dutch had great pirates going and great privateers where they would jump the Spanish gold fleets and jump the Spanish silver fleets and take the money as their own. And then something happened in 1637 known as Tulip Mania. And basically, any gardeners here today that garden and know about tulips, well, it was a period of the Dutch Golden Age which contract prices for bulbs of recently introduced tulips reached extraordinarily high levels in the